Hello, everybody. Welcome to today's Talky Bit. As always, it is good to be with you. Here we go. Let's talk a little bit about life and death in a banana peel universe. I have never had the privilege of being with someone when they died. My dad always used to say it was one of his great regrets that he'd never had that experience. And as events sort of in the past had transpired, I wasn't able to make that ground up by being with him when he died. So it was sort of looking like we were on the path of, you know, generational regret in this regard. But my mom's story went another way. When she woke up the Thursday before last, she made two things very, very clear. The first was that she loved my sister Karen. She took Karen's face in her hands and she told her so with undeniable clarity and with repetition. I love you, I love you, I love you. And the second thing that she communicated was that she loved and wanted to see her people, all of them, if possible. She wasn't overtly talking about dying, but she was letting those that were around her know what mattered to her, and she was doing that in ways that suggested that this matter was one of great importance to her and also of some urgency. So, Karen sent me a text that said in caps, "Come soon," which we did. And we got to Saskatoon in time to see Mom while she still had some idea who was in the room and that the Winnipeg part of her clan had finally arrived. And then she sort of got on with the business of dying. And we got to be there with her, talking to her, singing to her, touching her, stroking her hands and her face, right to the end, or the beginning. Or, I mean, how do we think about this anyway? I mean it. I deep down mean it when I say I got to be there. And I don't just mean met the deadline. I mean had the privilege of it. And when I talk about this, I know I'm talking about it through sort of a fog of sadness and grief. Having acknowledged that, I can also honestly say that in my experience with my mom, the end of life is every bit as mysterious and I would also say even fascinating as the beginning. I won't get into the details of my mom's last moments in terms of the embodied part of her journey, and I won't do that for the same kind of reasons that I wouldn't graphically describe the details of my children's births, which I was also privileged to be present for. It's one of those, you kind of had to be in the room, I guess you had to be there sorts of moments where it feels as though the details would be more of a distraction from the profundity than not. But I can tell you that a sense of being privileged to be there prevailed for me. It even felt, at least in moments, that the privilege prevailed over the sorrow. I've realized in retrospect that I've been thinking about that moment in my mom's life for a while now. Maybe even from before the time when we heard about her cancer diagnosis. Taya and I have been reading through the works of speculative fiction author Becky Chambers. I know I've raved about her work here before. I expect I will again. Bear with me if that doesn't resonate for you. One of the things that Chambers does over and over again is use imagined worlds to bring her characters and in turn her readers face to face with big compelling questions. That's one of the things I love about her writing. And in the book that Tay and I are reading at the moment, which is called Record of a Spaceborn Few, one of the characters is a Harmagian journalist. Now, if you've never read Chambers, Harmagian won't mean anything to you. I don't want to take up a lot of space trying to describe this species, except to say that if you or I met one, we would find them to be utterly foreign. By which I do not mean speak a different language, have a different culture. I mean have a different body. That is very not human. They're kind of like when they're adults, if you want to use human language for it. They're kind of like a giant slug with tentacles. when they're young, they're more like tadpoles or polyps. They grow attached to rocks in the hundreds, and then detach from that and swim, and then eventually emerge as a Harmagian. And they get around on carts when they're on planets that have gravity. I mean, it, utterly foreign is the emphasis I want to make in this instance. In any case, in this story, one of the Harmagian characters is visiting a human friend of hers, Isabel, whom we're going to meet in a moment. Isabel lives in what is called the Fleet, which is a collection of very large spaceships that had long ago taken the last remnants of humanity from the dying planet Earth into space, sort of in a last-ditch attempt to save the species. So the interdependence and the structures of interdependence on within the Fleet, life in the Fleet, are understandable and to most of us would seem remarkably intertwined. They needed one another in that journey. In the process of sort of fleeing Earth into space, which they understood when they left Earth, much like we would understand it, there might be life out there, but they hadn't encountered it. So as far as they knew, they were headed off into relative void, hoping that they would find some way to survive there. But in the meantime, living on the, in the Fleet. In the process, they discovered that they were not alone in the universe and that the other species that they encountered knew things that could and did save humanity from extinction. So the other species turned out to be superior in terms of knowledge and some other things. And so that's how the human race survives and this particular set of chambers works. In the book that I just referenced, what's happening is that someone, a human from the Fleet, has just died under unclear circumstances. And Gulolan, the Harmagian journalist, is observing how the humans handle this experience of this person's death. She writes an essay about it, and that essay is included in full in the book. So when I read it out loud to Taya, she said, "Oh, Dad, you should read that at the table." I'm not going to read it all, but I'm going to read you a bit of it, and then I'm going to tell you why Taya said that, if it's not apparent. So let me just read you a little bit of this essay. So remember, the author is Harmagian, not human. All right. "I used to assume, when I first began to study the lives of my sapient neighbors, that perhaps sleep would better prepare those species for death. Sleep sounds quite like death to me, a strange temporary death complete with an afterlife of surreal visions." That's a typical Chambers, a description of what we would call dreams, right? "I have heard both a human and an Andrisk," another species, "on separate occasions posit that death must feel like nothing more than a, quote, dreamless sleep. You would think, then, that these species are less fearful of the inevitable end. If one experiences oblivion daily, and for an enormous portion of the day at that, should it not be familiar territory?" I was wrong about this, of course. Some species have a more passive reaction to death than others. I am thinking here of the Laru, with their total lack of funerary customs, but sleep or no, all fear it. All spend lifetimes trying to outstretch its grasp. In a highly social species, such as my human hosts, a death is keenly felt, even if it is that of a stranger. Certainly, I have been moved by the end of those I did not know. But humans habitually react in a way that members of my own species might find extreme. A single death, regardless of relation, can dominate conversation for days on end. It takes over news feeds, workplace chatter, decisions about the day. A death always fixates humans in one direction or the other. They either talk about it at any opportunity or doggedly avoid the topic. I did not have a good hypothesis as to why this might be until I joined my dear host Isabel for dinner at her hex. Hex is a synonym for home within the Fleet. So at her home tonight. There has been an unusual death in the Fleet, accidental or purposeful, no one yet knows, and the families could speak of little else. All species emote around death, but there is an intensity of mood here I am unaccustomed to. I cannot stop pondering it. As I sat witness to this behavior tonight, two individuals caught my eye, Isabel and Tasman's son, Miguel, holding his young daughter, Katja, on his lap. His embrace was snug, and he was stroking her hair as the others spoke and argued. At first, I thought the gesture was an order to calm or reassure her. Perhaps consciously, that is why he did it. But Katya was paying no attention to the conversation. She was fully engrossed in building a fortress out of mashed vegetables on her plate. If she registered the topic at hand, I do not think she understood much of it. But still, her father held and stroked, and the longer the conversation went on, the more affectionate he became. I thought then of the means of human reproduction. It is an intense process, an internal process. Even though her father did not go through this process himself, he was close audience to it. As is commonly the case, he was romantically partnered with Nina, Ketcha's mother. Human infants are famously frail, and the amount of time they remain dependent on adults for needs as basic as eating or locomotion makes me wonder how the species didn't give up on the whole prospect millennia ago. Perhaps I am completely wrong about linking these two behaviors, dear guest, but I find it likely that there is a connection, even if only a tenuous one, between humans' heavy parental involvement in child-rearing and how socially unsettled they become around death. Were I among my own kind, and had someone met a sad end, it would be discussed, certainly. If I knew the deceased, I would visit their family to recite my praise of their life, as is proper. But I would not think of my offspring in that time. This would not occur to me. My offspring are not the ones who have died. I would know them to be well. Depending on age, I would know them to be swimming safely in their ponds, or being mindfully reared by their tutors, or living in homes of their own. I would not imaginatively transfer the misfortune of another onto them. I would not worry about them unless given reason. Human parents always worry. Their offspring developed while not attached not to rocks, but to themselves. And unlike Harmagians, who bid farewell to polyps and welcome new children in their stead, it's a kind of death metaphor. Human progeny have but once to die. Taya, although not involved in this community in any ongoing way, is very aware of why we exist. And she recognized in this work of speculative fiction the same kind of work we gather each week to do, the exploration of belief. She could tell that the author was working to find a creative way to question the manner in which we humans respond to or shy away from responding to death. I felt the same when I read that. On the back cover of the edition that we're reading from, the question is raised, quote, "What is the purpose of a ship that has reached its destination?" In other words, in the context of the story, as important, even life-saving as the ship, or in this case the fleet of ships, may have been, as crucial to the survival as the values that guide the fleet's inhabitants' lives has been, now that the reason for its very existence is in the past, that the species has been saved, why carry on inside that system? That's the sort of question that could certainly be applied to exploring what we believe. In fact, that might be one way to describe what so many of us have experienced or are experiencing. Like the ship that got us here is no longer relevant to what we found upon our arrival, no longer necessary. And yet, it's familiar. It might even sometimes still have moments where it feels like home. We know how things worked here. Or at least we feel like we do until something goes awry. But we also sense that it might be time to move on, to start to live in the present rather than in the past. But it's hard to leave. Not least of all because there are still good things here. It's a tricky space to be in, isn't it? No pun intended with space. Which brings me to the banana peel universe in the blurb. I've mentioned this moment before, but I keep coming back to it because for me, it made something that I often experience as abstract feel very concrete. I've stood, my claim to fame, I've stood on Isaac Newton's grave. It's in the nave of Westminster Abbey in London, England. And so should you have the privilege of being in London, England, you could also have this experience if you wished. In what I felt like was a delicious twist that feels like it can't possibly be coincidental, Newton's grave is located right next to the grave of the contemporary physics genius Stephen Hawking. Newton was an English mathematician, a physicist, an astronomer, an alchemist, a theologian, interesting combination that, author, widely recognized as one of the greatest mathematicians and physicists of certainly that stream of history and from most European perspectives of all time, and certainly among the most influential scientists in that cultural milieu. Lived in the 1700s, was a key figure in the philosophical revolution that we now broadly think of as the Enlightenment. Key ideas of the Enlightenment, to really kind of cut to the chase in our context, included ideas like the prominence of reason and of evidence as gathered by observation by the senses. That was the evidence that had merit. That's the kind of evidence you would use to make decisions. And it's from this period in history that we get the idea of the universe functioning like a giant clock, a very large, very sophisticated machine. Some of us might even have memories, as I do, of having had sort of theological debates about whether it was legitimate to think of God as sort of a cosmic clockmaker, someone who kind of built the clock, wound it up, got it in motion, and then stepped back to let it run. What I find so interesting about, and it's a metaphor for me, but about Newton's grave being next to Hawking's, is that contemporary physics is telling us very different things about the universe than Newton's physics did. For example, we're learning that the particles that are the constituent parts of everything can be two different things in two different places at the same time. In Newton's universe, that would be impossible, or a miracle, another way of saying impossible for us to understand. String theory, contemporary string theory, gives us glimpses of how everything, and I mean everything, is vibrating. I heard a comedian recently call it the Big Twang theory, which I thought was great. We're learning that we live in a world where we won't be able to know everything or control everything or predict everything ever again. The universe, we're learning, is slippery, like a banana peel, not predictable or solvable like a clockworks. What does all this have to do with what we believe in general, and more particularly, in the context of this reflection, what we believe about things like the great human mysteries of birth and death? Well, that's an enormous thing to speculate about. So I'm going to go this way. We continue to be compelled, as a species, to make guiding stories. We make those stories from the raw materials of what we know, what we experience, what we speculate about. We use the linguistic tools we have, the cultural setting we're in, to put those stories together. It follows, it seems to me, that we are going to make different stories about death in a banana peel universe than we will in a clockwork one. As a person who grew up surrounded by quotes from Jesus, I can't help but think of how often the Gospels have him using the phrase, "You have heard it said, but I say," and then taking some conventional belief, some long-standing, deeply grounded, this is the truth of the world belief, and standing it on its head. And lots of those beliefs were also beliefs about the mystery for which we use God language. Now, whether that particular tradition is one that intrigues you or not, I think it's instructive to observe how 2,000 plus years after the fact, we're still working with, we're still talking about the insights of someone who wasn't afraid to explore what they and what those around them believed. Those explorations so intrigued the people who were drawn into the consideration of those things that they turned them into a religion. Those insights continued to intrigue and continue to this day to intrigue to such a degree that that religion that was made out of those inspired followers is one of the largest representations of religion on the planet. I'm not saying all of that to argue for the merit of a particular system of belief, as much as I'm saying all of that to argue for the merit of continuing to explore what we believe, to be clear. One more thought, and then we'll leave this for today. Life in what I've called the banana peel universe can be difficult. And not least of all, when we're processing the loss of someone we love, when we are dealing with death. This may not be the case for everyone, but I have had the thought that that process would be easier in a clockwork setting, where I could say, or we could say, I know how this works. I know what comes after death, and I am certain about it. So keep your evolving ideas to yourself. Thank you very much. You're getting in the way of my grief process. And we can choose that, of course. That is one of the available choices. But for those of us that choose to explore what we believe, even when it takes us to places where the ideas feel more slippery than solid, I think it's important to have a kind of plan for how we'll operate in the world in the meantime. Plan might be a bit strong. Let's say intent instead, or trajectory, direction. And I want to leave us today with something that I hope can be inspiring when we find ourselves wondering how to deal with death and loss in a not clockwork reality. Hardly a surprise to some of you, I'm sure, that it's a poem. I'll leave the poem to be a surprise or not, depending on what you read. But I should just say, so I don't have to interrupt the flow of the poem when we get there, that there's an important piece of punctuation in it. And no, to reference an earlier talky bit by Tim Penner, it is not an Oxford comma. It's a colon. And a colon, the two dots at the end of the phrase, signifies that what comes after changes voice or is a list, those kind of things. And I'll just remark on when the colon occurs so you understand what happens after that. If you were seeing it in print, you'd recognize it. The poem is called Cold Solace, as you'll discover, also an interesting play on words in itself. Cold Solace, the poet is Annabel Kaufman. When my mother died, one of her honey cakes remained in the freezer. I couldn't bear to see it vanish, so it waited, pardoned, in its ice cave behind the metal trays for 2 more years. On my 41st birthday, I chipped it out, a rectangular resurrection, hefted the dead weight in my palm. Before it thawed, I sawed with serrated knife the thinnest of slices. Jewish Eucharist. The amber squares with their translucent panes of walnuts, tasted, even toasted, of freezer, of frost, a raisined delicacy delivered up from a deli in the underworld. I yearned to recall life, not death, the still body in her pink nightgown on the bed, how I lay in the shallow cradle of the scattered sheets after they took it away, inhaling her scent one last time. I close my eyes, savor a wafer of sacred cake on my tongue, and try to taste my mother, to discern the message she baked in these loaves when she was too ill to eat them. : I love you. It will end. Leave something of sweetness and substance in the mouth of the world. That's the end of the poem. But let me just reprise the message that Annabel Kaufman feels like she discerns in the sacred cake on her tongue. I think it's good guidance for us if we find ourselves navigating a banana peel universe around big questions, big mysteries, and wondering if we're having a stay or go moment, what we should do in the meantime. Here's the message. I think this is incredibly beautiful, deeply grounded in reality, also thoroughly engaged with mystery. I love you. It will end. Leave something of sweetness and substance in the mouth of the world. As life missions go, leaving something of sweetness and substance in the mouth of the world can take us to a lot of pretty great places. So I leave that with you. I commend it to you as resonant with the sorts of things that can guide us in the same kinds of directions that the best enduring ways of believing and engaging with mystery do. The intersection of love, finitude, and choice, all in there in ways that just a rich mixture, very strong. I love you. It will end. Leave something of sweetness and substance in the mouth of the world. Peace to you all. It's been good to be with you. And I look forward to the next time we're together.